Live from Burbank, California, the world capital of urban runoff. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now he drains into the sea. Mark Maron.
Come on, don't we all drain into the sea, Jim? How are you, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, and of course you need machines and pain sponges. What's going on? Hey, I do want to, right off the bat, Jim, got to say thank you. Thank you. Thank you, G-Girl. Look at what she sent us. A big box of stuff, man.
That was G-Girls?
Z-Girl.
Z-Girl.
Z-Girl from the blog. Z-Girl. Look, she says, fellas, and this was addressed to Jim and Sleepy Bill Kolar and myself.
Right.
No one knows Andy. I got to give Andy a nickname. You know, Laughing Andy. How about Laughing Andy? It's Laughing Andy, because that's all I see. I can't hear him. Back in the old days, I used to hear him pipe right into my head, but not anymore. They were separate in the booth.
It's I call him something different?
I'm in a capsule. It's like I'm NASA. What? What do you want to call him?
Clown. What? Clown.
You just want to call him Clown?
Clown, yeah.
No, Jim, let me read this. I'm all juiced up.
I want to deliver it like this, so. Clown.
Okay. I'll tell you right now, Earl, you don't pick up your pace right away, you can't stay on the boat. You understand? I'm jammed.
Boat?
We got to
jammed?
We're in a space capsule. That's NASA in there. Look in there. You see those? There's Laughing Andy. You can't call him Clown. You got to call him Laughing Andy because that's all you can see.
Right.
So here we go. Right. Fellas, just wanted to say thanks for continuing to fight with us while making us laugh our asses off. Muchas smooches. Zoe Z-Girl and Pedro El Gato Loco Valentino sent us some bourbon balls. You can eat those. I can't eat those. That's all I need. It's like, hey, this looks like fun candy. 2 weeks later, I'm strung out on crack downtown at a hooker hotel. All right. Here, we got a vegetarian cookbook, bourbon balls. She sent me some cat ass magnets. Did you see those?
No, I did not see those.
I have never seen those. Like, I don't have enough cat ass in my life. I got some cat ass magnets now. She sent another nice book of poetry by a guy that was a friend of Hunter S. Thompson's that we should get on the show. I'd reach down and get it, Jim, but I don't have complete confidence in your ability to cover for me.
I'm covering for you right now. Andy, you're a clown.
Oh, the book wasn't in there. Oh. Also, we've got the book's in there. Yeah, Charlie's Holden book. All right, that's great. It's not going to do me any good right now. Also, King Kong sent a package from China. Got some Chinese candies. Choco Fun, Choco Play, something. Hold on.
That's
that box in there. You know, I had them bring this whole box in here specifically to do this bit, and then I left the other dumb box in there. It's not even a bit. It's just a
What's
a
King
thing.
Kong doing in China anyway? Where is he? Taiwan?
We have interesting listeners, man.
You know, we have that whole map of listeners,
too. Sleepy Bill Kolar bringing it in. He's waking up, though.
People all over this
globe. Oh, they're the
globe.
Bourbon balls. Here, why don't you eat one of these and see if you get wasted. Eat a bourbon ball. The Third Testament, Three Gospels of Peace by Ron Whitehead. Yeah, that's a guy.
Throw it over here.
Have you ever heard of Ron Whitehead, dude?
Ron Whitehead?
Yeah, have you ever heard of him?
No.
He and Hunter S. Thompson were good buddies,
really?
Which means two things. Dude liked guns and drugs, all right? So maybe we should have him on the show.
That's a good combo for poetry.
All right, let's get into some business here. Today on the show, we got Sam Green. I'm very excited about this, a little nervous. Now, I don't know if I'm nervous, but Sam Green, the documentary filmmaker of The Weather Underground, Oscar-nominated documentary, will be here to talk about making that film, to talk about The Weather Underground. Also, we managed to get Mark Rudd, who was in the Weather Underground as an active participant in it. He was originally with the SDS at Columbia University and led the student protest there in the late 60s and went on to become one of the Weather Underground. He's going to be on the phone with us from New Mexico, where he lives now.
The SDS being the
Students for a Democratic Society. This is a very interesting thing, given what we're dealing with now in this country and given the state of activism in this country, because certainly what we're doing here on some level of is activism. Without a doubt, Air America is doing a bit of that, a lot of that. There are people out in the streets, there are people mobilized, but I think about it all the time in terms of when I was like 7 years old in the late 60s watching these guys on television, seeing the hippies and seeing what was going on socially. I wanted nothing more than to be part of that. I have to say that the good part of my early life was dictated by what I thought hippies were, what the 60s represented. I was completely fascinated with counterculture, with drugs. I wanted to live that life. But I'll tell you, there's not many kids coming up like that anymore. They've either reinvented it, and it no longer has the momentum that it once had, clearly, or else they're just posing. I don't know. My fascination with what the Weathermen were about, what the Weather Underground was about, and watching the movie was just that the entire country was basically divided in two. There was the old generation that represented capitalism, the Eisenhower people, and then this whole other thing that was going on. Now, everything seems to be fragmented, and I was talking about it yesterday, and I didn't mean to make this come out the way it did to somebody. Someone misunderstood it, and that just goes to show I shouldn't be reading the blog. But what happened after the Vietnam War to the left, the fragmentization, the fragment, what is, how, is that a word? Fragmentization?
Destabilization.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah, big word. Throw the big word in there that means breaking apart. Whatever happened, it just, I don't think it's ever recovered from that. And I think a lot of it has to do, I even started questioning, like when I started thinking about TV and I started thinking about the choices, and when you started to think about the 60s, there were literally three TV stations on. That was it. So everybody was basically getting the same information, whether it was wrong or biased, clearly it was, but it was still the same. So when the country divided and there was us and them, it was a much bigger us and them. Now the TV and the computer are sort of like divide and conquer boxes. I mean, literally, with all your choices, with all the things that you could and are, you know, guided to be interested in, I mean, how can you stay on the same page? How can there be any collective momentum?
I think people are just numbed by all the stimuli they have.
I think there's that, but I also think that they have elevated their own personal causes to a point where they think it's important. That was another thing that's interesting about the film that we'll talk to him about, is that during the momentum of the 60s, during the SDS and during the Weather Underground's heyday, there was a call for this, you know, a giant protest in Chicago where they were going to take on the cops. And all the different franchises of the SDS and the Weather Underground were going to send kids to heed this call to fight the cops in Chicago. So they were sitting there expecting hundreds of thousands of people to show up, and literally 200 people showed up. And I think that's some of the same misconception you get today in terms of self-importance, in terms of how much momentum one has when you have the internet, when you have MySpace, when you have this self-promotional juggernaut that is, everybody misrepresents himself. Few people have any real cultural momentum. It's very hard to get your message out and to surface, you know, on top of the cultural simulacra or whatever you want to call it, and actually make a point. It's just a rare thing that happens.
Yeah.
And I think people are selfish. This also has something to do with what I was talking about before. If you really want to facilitate change, if that is your only concern, if you're a revolutionary, if you're saying, we got to do everything we can to take down this system, to take down this administration, to facilitate change, if you're that guy that walks into that room full of friends and go, come on, what are we going to do about Iran? What are we going to do about this Israel and Iran trouble? You're going to be the draining guy. And it's rare that those friends are going to jump up and go, you're right, I'll paint the signs, let's hit the streets. That's why occasionally on days of protest, you'll see like maybe one or two people at a corner with Stop Bush signs, and Out of Iraq, there's only two people. That's because there's like 30 or 40 friends at home that they just drained, and they're sitting there going, man, she was really freaked out about it. You think we should go out there? Oh, dude, I'm tired. Let's watch this movie. That's sort of a problem, is that it is out of fashion to be radical.
So you're saying it's kind of like a tyranny of the individual over the whole. You're saying that people are obsessed with their own personal gain and goals.
Yes. I think that is absolutely true. Then some people who pay lip service to being agitators or people that want to facilitate change are still completely self-involved. And every once in a while, they'll mingle and they'll come together in the perfect match. Like, I'm not saying, look, Jerry Rubin, Abby Hoffman, we're completely self-aggrandizing, self-promoting lunatics, but they were at the right time and they were, you know, heading up. They were great leaders in terms of the yippies and the hippies and everything else, and in terms of getting it out there into the culture. Today, every once in a while, those two things will come together. I can't really remember one in my recent memory, but every once in a while, somebody's selfishness. You got to have a certain amount of ego to be that type of leader, to be that type of changer of culture. And every once in a while, that type of selfishness will just have the right mixture with cultural momentum and actually facilitate some change. But I think people now, it's all about, like, me, look at me, here's my show, look what I'm doing. And I'm sending a few bucks over here. I'll pay a little lip service to helping the folks out in Iraq and
American
Idol. Post-Katrina. Look how many people vote on that damn show, and we can't get a, you know.
Well, you get to vote twice, you know, if you want to.
I don't even know who's running. I know there's a guy with the grayish hair, salt and pepper hair, and there's some girl.
Heather voted for him.
Oh, why do you?
I didn't vote. I sat there.
Talentless garblers.
I went. Ugh.
All right, look, we got Chris Rose, who I met in, down in New Orleans when I was doing a benefit down there. He's got a book called One Dead in Attic. He's also was the entertainment reporter down at the now Pulitzer Prize-winning Times-Picayune.
Well, that sounds funny. Right.
Hey, no. He's a decent guy, and he's got a good heart and a comedic spirit, and we're going to talk to him about his book and about being a Pulitzer Prize winner, bitter boy.
Hey, you know, I have awards.
You got a Peabody?
Yeah.
You got an Emmy?
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah. Shall I bring them in?
You got the Peabody, too?
Yeah.
Wow. I stand corrected.
And now, do not induce vomiting. Mark Maron.
Wow. Thanks, Jim. I didn't finish setting up the set. I got all excited about stuff. Well, Chris Rose is going to be on here in a minute. He's the author of One Dead in Attic, Pulitzer Prize-winning Times-Picayune reporter. Will Franken, a comedian from San Francisco, is going to be here in just a few minutes. But right now, we don't want you to be caught off guard or uninformed. Here's edition one of Mark Maron Show's Short Order News. President Bush said Tuesday that if Israel were attacked by Iran, the United States would come to its aid. The president also promised that even if a country wasn't being attacked, there's a good chance we'll show up anyway. According to a new study at the University of California, Los Angeles, marijuana smoking does not increase a person's risk of developing lung cancer. Well, that's good news. This just in, according to a new study at the University of California, marijuana smoking does not increase a person's risk of developing lung cancer.
Mark, you just read that.
Huh?
Oh, man.
Come on, man. I'm trying to get through this. An exotic chicken that was saved from drowning by mouth-to-beak resuscitation more than 3 months ago has died, her owner said Tuesday. Meanwhile, Elton John has agreed to rewrite Candle in the Wind again. That's the short order news for now. That's the short order news for now. Did I say that twice?
Mm.
Wow.
No,
what's
you
going
didn't.
On?
You only said it once.
People, Chris Rose was basically an entertainment reporter in New Orleans before Katrina. He still is. But the impact the event had on him, like many other residents of the city, was cathartic and life-changing. In response to the aftermath of Katrina, Chris Rose wrote the book One Dead in Attic. His paper, The Times-Picayune, just won a Pulitzer. Chris Rose is on the phone with us now. How are you, Chris?
I'm doing good. Doing good. Small correction, 2 Pulitzers.
Oh.
I have just returned from the festivities in New York.
Now let me see. Do you actually get a trophy yourself?
I don't get one. My own personal deal. I was a runner up in a single category or individual category to Nicholas Kristof for commentary
for the book or for actually articles you wrote.
No, that's for the articles I wrote, and his dispatches from Darfur I think weighed a little heavier than mine did. But I was part of 2 group wins that we had. So no, I don't get the check for $10,000 or that nice little crystal. I think they're going to give me a plastic replica.
Oh, they should give you a crystal, because I figure, you know, you're part of it, and who knows, maybe in the future you might see. I just picture you in a pawn shop like Jake LaMotta in Raging Bull.
That's it.
You know, with the jewels from the belt, and the guy going, "Where's the belt?"
What does a reporter want more than a nice piece of Waterford crystal, really, in the end, to validate his career?
Yeah, validate his life, exactly. Because when you're gone, the crystal remains. So, Chris, now tell me, you were just a guy on the beat, on the music beat, right? And on the arts beat before Katrina.
Yeah, and you know, arts and music might even be an elevated term for it. I was, I sort of covered behind the scenes stuff here. You know, we had, and are trying to rekindle a burgeoning Hollywood scene here. We usually had 3 or 4 major productions going on, and I did a lot of behind the scenes stuff there, nightclub stuff, celebrity culture. I don't know, it's possible that I was just an overpaid celebrity stalker with a pencil instead of a camera.
Hey, well, that's called a reporter in a lot of papers these days. But what happened was, is this tragic event occurs, unfolds, continues to unfold, and you were sort of called, you know, there's a calling there, you know, you realized at that moment, it must have been some moment where you're just a guy doing this art scene, hanging out, having a good time, living the life, and bang, all of a sudden it's like, Chris, time to be a real reporter.
It kind of was. I guess I didn't hear the voice till later. But I had evacuated with my family, and the minute everything came down in the town, of course, I was itching to get back in here. I've been doing all kinds of reporting for 22 years. The arts and entertainment was just the most current. But I was, it is a calling. You don't prepare for war for 22 years, and when the battle starts, not be there for it. So
now
I came rushing into town and basically covered the story as it unfolded to me with no plan, no contrivance whatsoever.
And all that writing, is that what comprises One Dead in Attic?
Yeah, the book is the columns I wrote, or most of them, from August 29th until January 1st.
Now
you got a chance to read it?
I've poked around at it. You know, I got a lot of books to read, but there's some really powerful stuff in here, certainly about what it felt like to be on the ground at that time and the struggle that people were going through and just how the city actually came together in some respects.
Yeah. A horrible and amazing story to be told. I know you were down here. I don't know how much you got around, but yeah, you know, so much of the reporting of this thing has been empirical in its nature, and I'm not sure if that's the right term, but everything.
I didn't understand
all the stories have weight or mass or volume or numbers.
Go.
How
yeah.
much money? How
right.
many dead?
Right.
How many millions of dollars? How big a storm? And what I did really from the beginning was sort of be led by emotion. I have been covering the very simple and inelegant process of what it's like to live here in New Orleans on a day-to-day basis, and that itself is a pretty big story. It's extreme.
Yeah, and now in terms of, like, we talked to Shyla Dewan from New York Times, and she's pretty good. She talks to the folks down there, and she has she always talks to people on the street down there. Now, in your feeling, are we turning a corner down there? How's the spirit of New Orleans? When I was down there, people were starting to kind of resurface, and there was a strength that they're like, there was definitely a feeling we're going to get through this. How was Jazz Festival? Did that turn things around a little?
Well, that was great. I mean, the celebrations and the triumphs of our human spirit have been, you know, the Mardi Gras was a real pick-me-up. The French Quarter Festival is always good. Jazz Fest was great. And what followed right on the heels of that, what's going on now, are the commencement exercises, which in themselves are small miracles here, that the high schools and colleges, universities are holding commencement exercises in buildings that had 4 feet of water in them for a month before. So these things pick us up. I'm a little worried about what happens now. June 1st is the first day officially of hurricane season, which doesn't mean we're going to see a big red blob on our Super Dopper 6000
right.
on the evening news, but it sort of harkens that the days of dread are upon us with no major celebrations or cultural events ahead of us. It's going to be a long, hot summer. We've turned a corner in a lot of ways, but, I think we're redefining, I don't know what the psychiatrists say, whether there's seven or nine
yeah.
stages of grief.
Yeah.
I think there's about, there's about 37 of them the way I see it.
Well, Chris, can we check back in with you in a couple of weeks as the time unfolds? Can you be a go-to guy in New Orleans?
Yeah, course? I'd love to do that. Can I tell people where to get the book real quick?
I got it on my website. I got the link.
There you go, man.
I'll say
yeah,
it
anytime
again.
You want to talk, we'll be here.
Thanks, buddy.
All right.
And now he killed the electric car. Mark Maron.
I had nothing to do with it. Did you watch that film?
I have not watched it yet, but I will.
We're going to, when that opens, we're going to have some guests on about it. It's right up your alley.
The electric car, alternative energy car alley, yes.
It definitely. Looked like a great car. It's one of those great stories, great sad stories, where, you know, big business, the oil industry, the state legislature, a few other business interests just destroyed something that could have been great. They actually were
absolutely.
Putting infrastructure in the Los Angeles area to fuel these things, fueling ports and everything else. And the oil companies and the car companies, the most amazing thing about, maybe we'll get Ed Begley on again to talk about
yeah.
the electric car, because I think he had one, is that the car companies didn't sell them. They only offered them on leases. Because they knew something was up. They were testing the waters. They didn't know if the paradigm was ready to shift, if the oil companies were going to allow this to happen, if the oil companies... It was a convolution of forces that crushed this thing. But the weird thing is none of them exist anymore, and they were available by car companies. And they took them back on the leases. Not even the wealthiest among us could have kept their electric car.
The history of steam and electric cars is interesting because steam goes back to the first steam car was in the late 1700s. The first electric cars were in the early 1800s, believe it or not.
Uh-huh.
But the thing, electric cars were the biggest and hottest selling form of independent transportation in around 1900 to 1906 until Texas. And Texas discovered the Kettleman, I believe, oil fields.
Yeah, I like it when you speak declaratively and then vaguely at the same time.
Well, getting to it. Texas, another great thing Texas has done for us. Anyway, gas became cheap then.
Yeah.
And so the gas powered engine.
Well, look,
came into being.
Well, you should watch the film, take some notes, figure out who you want on the show. We'll get him on the show. Chris Rose, who was at the show, just on the show. You can go to chrisrosebooks.com or you can go to markmaron.com and link. We got a link there for his book, One Dead in Attic, about New Orleans. A very touching book. He almost won a Pulitzer for this. This is a guy who just wrote movie stuff. Also, yesterday on the show, some of you in the L.A. area were cut into the middle of this. I didn't want to give this guy short shrift. J.R. Norton, Jim Norton, the cat who used to produce the Al Franken show, his book, Saving General Washington, I feel a little guilty because I didn't read enough of it to have a thorough enough interview with him that I would like, because I'm reading it now, and I just want to make sure that this book is out there and you guys know about it. If you don't know a lot about the Founding Fathers and you want to read it in a pretty concise and funny and intelligent way, it's a great book. And I'm not doing this because I have to. It was just one of those situations where I left the show yesterday. I felt bad about the way the interview went because I wanted to know more than I did. And then I read half the book last night, and I felt like an ass because it could have been so much funnier.
You don't have to feel like an ass about something like that. I think you're obsessive about it. I think the interview was fine on its own.
I am obsessive. And another thing I'm obsessing about is that yesterday we went off in this little conversation about the constitutionality of what is going on with Congressman Jefferson from Louisiana and the very curious behavior of the Republican leaders in the House of Representatives in terms of asking the FBI to return the stuff that was taken from Jefferson's office because they feel that it violates the separation of powers that is implied in the Constitution of the United States of America, that there are checks and balances and each branch has its own trip going on, and that's my own phrasing there. And that these somehow or another, the executive branch has overstepped its bounds by using the FBI in this way. What I don't understand, Jim, and maybe I'm a little screwy on this, it's a little convoluted. There's a couple things I don't understand. One, why did the FBI go after, evidence from Congressman Jefferson's office around a convoluted, potential bribery scandal that involves a Nigerian official, whereas they did nothing like that for the 6 to 7 to 12 to 15 Congress people, members of Congress, that were involved in either the Duke Cunningham scandal or the Jack Abramoff situation. None of that went on. No FBI, no investigations like that. All right, that's my first, that's one question.
That's the abuse of power coming in.
That's the abuse of power, absolutely.
However justified it may be to investigate William Jefferson, I'm sure it's very justified. The guy looks like he broke the law.
Okay, fine. But now here, the two things that are out there in the mainstream media is Democratic congressman is under investigation by the FBI. They went to his office and removed things from his congressional office. That is pretty dire, considering it's never happened before. Okay, you have that. So that frame is out there. That is in no way going to dwarf or trivialize the amount of trouble the Republicans are in, if that was their intent. So that can't be their intent. Now what I don't understand is how is it that Hastert and John Boehner are now saying, bring the stuff back, you guys overstepped your bounds, to the president, to the executive branch. And Alberto Gonzalez is saying, well, we sort of need to do this, but maybe we can meet in the middle. Why all of a sudden do these two guys, these lapdogs, these lackeys to this administration, all of a sudden they've got principles now about checks and balances? They've been doing the president's bidding for what? For 6 years now? Almost relentlessly? And all of a sudden now it's like, hey, I think you guys might have overstepped your bounds. Is this them? This distancing themselves from the president? Is this them protecting themselves from the possibility of an FBI investigation into Republican congressmen? What is the politics behind this? I guess I'm not astute enough to figure out how to read it. Yesterday I was talking about how it's like, of course they're going to freak out. They don't want their own selves to be investigated. But now I'm thinking, because of the way the president is being seen by Republicans, by the base, they're seeing it as an opportunity to distance themselves from the president. I don't know. I can't quite figure it out. I'm sure now that I bring it up, some of my bloggers will be, oh, Marin, you know, wake up, dude. Don't drink the Kool-Aid. For whatever reason, I'm drinking the Kool-Aid. That the whole thing is just a distraction. Maybe the whole thing is just a big distraction from the real elements of corruption that are plaguing this administration and the GOP at this point in time. On top of everything else, dig this. Pakistani government sources told ABC News they have credible reports that Osama bin Laden and his entourage, his posse, have moved down from the high mountainous peaks along the Afghan border to a valley area 40 miles inside the Pakistan border. It sounds to me that someone ought to go to the web, you know, someone who's got some power. It looks like they know where he is within a 40-mile radius.
You see, I heard he was buried at a horse farm.
Under a barn in Missouri?
Or Michigan or whatever.
Next to Jimmy Hoffa?
Yeah. that's just my info.
Look, I think he might be in a cement bunker beneath the White House. But look, the bottom line that I'm trying to get at here is that you look at the corruption, okay? You look at the fact that Osama bin Laden, if ABC News can get him, you know, within a 40-mile radius, they know where he is, and he's not dead or captured.
Well, we got 40-mile radius bombs, don't we?
Bombs? I mean, you could go find him. You could sort of scan that. We got pictures. You could do it without a bomb. You could probably go arrest the guy. And on top of that, the Taliban, U.S. forces in Afghanistan have acknowledged that the Taliban are now regaining strength and influence all over Afghanistan. Okay, so the Afghanistan war, failure, wasn't finished. Taliban's coming back. Osama bin Laden, he seems to be out and about, and you know, we know where he is. He's down from the mountains, okay? Failure on behalf of George Bush. The level of corruption and indictments within his inner sanctum, within the vice president's office, between Libby and hopefully Rove. We're going to have Jason Leopold on, I think, in a couple of days, so we can clear up this thing, where the hell he got his information. He's not going to break. He's just going to want to sell his book. But nonetheless, the corruption around Jack Abramoff and Duke Cunningham within the GOP House of Representatives is insane. Delay his indictment is... These guys have failed on everything. $10 billion a month on the Iraqi war, and the Taliban is regaining power, and Osama bin Laden's walking around. I don't know how the hell. Look, we had that woman on yesterday, Kirsten Powers, who I think I handled well, because I didn't. I thought she was a sort of a lackey for the DNC. In that, I don't know. It's Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton is
not the right choice.
No, for two reasons. One, I don't think this country is not ready to elect a female.
But that shouldn't be the reason. That shouldn't be the reason.
No, it shouldn't be the reason, but this country is not ready. This country won't elect a female. This country isn't ready to give them equal pay, you know, for the same job.
This country isn't ready
to give them rights over their body. Why should they want to elect a female?
I don't know if you can say that this country is not willing to give them rights over their body. There is a loudmouth, you know, narrow-minded faction of this country, when pressed, you know, will not give them rights over their body, and certainly the Supreme Court's not going to help that. But I have thought about, you know, whether or not that we are ready for a woman president, and I think we are, quite honestly. And I think that if there's going to be one, it's going to be her, and could be her.
Well, we had Calvin Coolidge.
But I think that I don't know if that's specifically true. I know that the right would love to run against Hillary because they can pull out all the crap that they used to throw at Bill. But just on a policy level, on a politics level, her sort of pandering to the moderates and her presentation of herself as a moderate, and her pandering to the Republican money base a little bit with this Rupert Murdoch thing is disturbing, because there isn't really a middle, and you do have to realize that the way her husband used to triangulate and all the good things that Clinton may have done, he was in some ways not so great. I mean, you would say, as a progressive Democrat, Jim, the trade agreements.
That was the worst thing he did. I mean, the guy sucked on that. I don't know what the hell he was thinking. He was caving. Every time the pressure was on, he caved in and moved to the right.
I think that, bottom line, we had Marcy Winograd in here once, and she was in here yesterday recording an ad. There's a group of progressive Democratic Congress people who are putting forward a movement to impeach the president, shamelessly and out loud saying we're going to impeach the president, as opposed to playing politics like some moderate senators and moderate moderate Congress people who are saying, hey, you know, don't scare the people with the word impeach. This guy's a criminal. George Bush is a criminal. We shouldn't be ashamed to throw the word impeached around. We shouldn't be ashamed to throw the words investigate thoroughly if we got the chance, if we got the House back around.
I think people in general, the average person on the street, is afraid to use the word impeach for some reason.
It's peculiar.
You don't see it on bumper stick. I don't see it. You know, I live in the Red Hills.
Rush Feingold.
Echo Park, where it used to be a communist haven in the 30s.
Yeah, in Highland Park, too, where I live. Yeah,
and, you know, there are all sorts of liberal bumper stickers, but nothing about impeachment.
Yeah. Look, we'll be here. This is going to be an ongoing conversation, obviously, later, because we got a comic coming in, a performance artist from the Bay Area, Will Franken. Stay with us for that. And that's all for now.
Welcome back. Today we are talking to survivors, survivors of tragedy and survivors of grief. With me today are three very, very brave survivors who are going to show us how they have survived and how we might learn from those who have survived. Let's start with my third guest. No, let's start with my first. My first guest is Karen Radford, whose daughter, Joessica, was killed last year, the victim of a pickaxe murderer. Karen is the founder and co-founder of Parents of Pickaxe Murdered Children, or POPAP, an organization that helps parents of pickaxe murdered children come to terms with their pickaxe murdered children's pickaxe murders. Karen, welcome. Tell us a little bit about POPAP and how it got started, and how does it differ from the other hundreds of thousands of organizations that already deal with murdered children?
Well, POPAM came out of what I felt to be a huge misunderstanding in the murdered child community. For months after Joessica was killed, I was approached by all sorts of people whose children had also been murdered, but none of their children had been murdered by a pickaxe, and I did not feel like I could relate. My child wasn't strangled with her own underwear. My child was killed by a pickaxe. We had one couple whose kid had been murdered by an axe. They somehow thought we'd gone through the same thing. But that's one thing that POPAMP makes clear in our literature, is there is a difference between a dinky little old axe murder, which just really makes a long horizontal gash in a body, and a pickaxe murder, which makes a much more circular, kind of deeper hole.
Tell us about the night that Joessica died.
I passed out drunk and my boyfriend killed her.
Oh, that's right. Karen, for those of us who are parents, are there any warning signs? How do you tell if your child is at risk to be murdered by a pickaxe murderer?
You have to know what your children are up to. Are your children associating with coal miners, for example? Also, prevention is key. Don't leave any sharpened pickaxes in your trailer, especially if your boyfriend's on PCP and thinks that your daughter's made out of gold.
Karen, thank you.
That is Will Franken, the performance artist / comedian / theatrical event. He was at the UCB here in Los Angeles last night, and we'll finish it by the time we are on the air tonight. So now tell me about what you're doing in Memphis. You're doing a benefit for the three guys who are in Paradise Lost. I saw that documentary. Now, they're all still alive?
They're all still alive. One's on death row. Damien Echols is...
Damien, the one who is, they really characterize as the most sort of demonic black...
supposedly the ringleader of this non-existent cult.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I'm trying to remember the movie because it was pretty fascinating. Where does that case stand now, and what exactly are you doing, and who else is involved?
Well, I think they've got just a few more appeals left. They're getting ready to go to the federal level, and I'm going out to Little Rock to do a show with some musicians and stuff on what they call West Memphis Awareness Day, which is June the 3rd, which is the day that the kids got arrested.
Okay.
So it's in honor of what they consider the unjust arrest date
for
these kids. So
And there's been no that the bottom line is that the evidence does not convict these guys.
There is none. There's absolutely none.
And they're just crucifying them because of their disposition, their attitude.
Yeah, it's the weirdest thing in the world. It's like, I mean, I grew up in Sedalia, Missouri, which is about probably 3 hours away from West Memphis, Arkansas, and it's very frightening when you've been away from a community like that for so long that there is this kind of insane Christian majority out there that really can believe in things like demons possess children to slaughter children.
Right.
When there is absolutely no evidence other than the fact that Damien had black hair and wore...
Isn't that interesting?
A Metallica t-shirt, yeah.
Just by virtue of the way the legal system is set up, if there's enough of those people that think that way,
exactly,
it can be abused on some level. Mm-hmm. And also just provincial thinking. If you have a small town,
right,
they all get into a groupthink kind. How big of a town did you grow up in?
25,000.
Which town was it?
Sedalia, Missouri.
Okay.
Give him a shout out.
Yeah. Sedalia.
What's up?
What's it like there, man?
Freaky. I haven't been back for years.
Did you run away?
I don't want to.
Yeah, it's okay. Let it out. It's time.
It's a little. Yeah. It's pretty sad. Yeah. It's just
got on that bus.
You know, I went to go where people read books.
Yeah.
And it was a little different. You know.
So where'd you go first? You were in New York.
Went to New York and became a New Yorker.
Yeah.
Instead.
You just kind of glommed on. Just kind of took on the personality.
Yeah. I found out about the. You have to bring 5 people to pay $5 to.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was
in
fives.
Where'd you live though? Where'd you find yourself?
Morningside Heights.
Okay.
You know it?
No. In Brooklyn?
No, it's kind of where Harlem meets Columbia University.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. Like in the hundreds, like 110th, 11th,
123rd.
Yeah. They used to have a comedy show up there, the West End Gate. Now, you were in New York for how long?
4 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, we talked about that before. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to figure out who you are, man, where you're going, dude.
It's
where are you living in San Francisco?
Where am I living in San Francisco? Lower Haight.
Ah, I live there.
Keeping it real.
Yeah, are you?
You lived in Lower Haight, really?
I lived over on Clayton and Fell, just across the way, on the Panhandle.
Yeah, right on.
Well, you're in the Lower Haight, so you go up a block. My buddy lives over there on Fell and DeViz. He used to, now he moved out.
Yeah, they got a nice Ethiopian restaurant there near in Lower Haight there. Yeah. What the hell are you guys talking about?
I'm just talking about San Francisco, dude.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
So,
Ethiopian.
Where are you working up there? What's going on? You got the Memphis 3 thing coming up, and then what?
Yeah, I got the. I'm doing a series of one-off shows at the Marsh Theater, which is in the Mission District. Valencia Street, 21st and 22nd.
Marsh.
I know the little Marsh.
You know the Marsh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I used to do shows there.
Well, there's
all the
Mock. There's the Mock, which is next door, which is where comedy gets regulated. And then there's the Big House, we call it.
I remember the Marsh Theater. It's on Valencia, right?
Yeah.
There's a great taqueria on the corner there.
What the hell are you talking about? What are you talking about? You started it.
Yeah, I know. Sorry.
Oh, man. Get those arm-sized burritos. I miss San Francisco. It's beautiful. I don't care.
Do you ever eat tongue burrito?
I'm a Jew. I never had a tongue burrito. Sorry, we had sliced tongue. We don't chunk it up and put it in with the rice. You slice it and you pickle it and you put it on a piece of rye bread.
You know, last time I was here, I had a brain taco.
Yeah, good for you.
You ever had one of
those?
Brain taco?
No, I didn't have
a
brain taco.
It tastes like aspirin, but it looks like brain. It's really weird.
It tastes like aspirin. It looks like aspirin.
Tastes like aspirin, looks like brain.
I hope it was good, clean brain, because if you eat the wrong kind of brain, it can screw up your brain.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it did for a little bit.
I bet you it did.
Little tiny brains, though. Look like.
Come on. What kind of brains? Is it a big brain?
Look like a series of little brains about half an inch wide.
Boy, someone took you for a ride. Hey, here's a guy with long hair and he's white. How'd you like the brain taco? We love it in our country.
Can you see the long hair on the radio?
Those are testicles, not brains.
Oh, my God. What's happened?
What's the difference, man?
Right on.
Once you're eating them and they're cooked, it doesn't really make a difference, does it?
Shout out.
Ugh. Peace. All right, Will Franken, good luck with everything.
Oh, willfranken.com. Can we say that?
Yeah, I got a link to it on the site. You can go there and see what he does. And good luck with the benefit. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
We'll be back with Sam Green and the Weather Underground film.
And now, call in for a free sample. Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. Hey, folks, I don't know. Maybe I'm I don't think I'm a crappy progressive, and certainly I consider myself a student of the counterculture. I grew up with it. My recollections of of the late 60s and 70s or of an eight-year-old. But I had no idea the extent of the anarchy, activism, damage, excitement that the Weather Underground reaped on the country in the name of peace in the late 60s and early 70s. A documentary, The Weather Underground, which came out last year, documents the creation, evolution, and dissolution of the group from its beginnings as an offshoot of the SDS to the end in the late 70s when almost all its members were underground. The filmmaker responsible for the Oscar-nominated documentary, Sam Green, is with us now, and Mark Rudd, a member of the Weather Underground, will be with us in a few minutes. So welcome to the show, Sam.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, look, I think I'm probably a little older than you, but I'm still not old enough to remember the impact of the Vietnam War and the SDS and the Weather Underground. You know, what drew you to them?
Well, I'm a bit younger than you, so I didn't really have any firsthand memory of the group at all. But I grew up in the 80s. I was a teenager in the 80s, and I was always interested in the 60s. I was a sort of political young person and never quite understood how the 80s had followed from the 60s. It didn't make sense to me. What had happened? So I always read a lot about the 60s, and the story of the Weather Underground was something that had piqued my interest as a teenager. They were sort of these swashbuckling characters, and I think I just responded to that as a teenage boy.
So why don't you set the stage a little bit for us, because I had to go out and research. The SDS was the Students for Democratic Society, and the Weather Underground sort of came out of the SDS, but also caused a fractionalization that might have ended the SDS, yes?
Yeah, the Students for Democratic Society was founded in the early 60s, and it was inspired by the civil rights movement, and it became a really big organization on college campuses across the country. And in the mid-60s, when the Vietnam War started to heat up and students got more and more concerned about that, the focus of the organization really shifted to that. And as 1966 became 67 and 8, and the war just got worse and worse, and people protested more and more, the organization became more and more radical. And Mark, who you're going to have on, is able to talk really in a first-hand manner about that. But that was the backstory to the Weather Underground. In 1969, the group sort of blew apart. Everybody was at their wit's end about how to stop the war and make change. And the Weather Underground was one faction that came out of that implosion.
Now, when you set out to do the film and you started meeting these members, it seemed that none of them were hiding their hearts from you, and that there was very little shame sense of regret on behalf of any of them, and many of them still had a certain amount of fire in their eye and a certain amount of passion about what they did. What did you find when you were making it that surprised you the most, or what were you looking for that you found that you didn't maybe expect?
Well, I think one of the things that surprised me the most is that I had expected for the former members of the group to be cynical or disillusioned. They had put all their eggs in one basket that the revolution was going to happen, and it obviously didn't happen. And so being a somewhat cynical and disillusioned person myself at that time, I expected to get some of the same from them. And I was always very surprised that they were still, for the most part, all of them were still activists, and they weren't bombing buildings or anything like that, but they were still involved and still believed that it was possible to make change, and they were actually pretty hopeful people. They didn't have the answer anymore, the thing to do to make a revolution tomorrow, but they were still plodding ahead, and that really surprised me and inspired me at the same time.
It seems that the only activists that are doing anything similar to what the Weather Underground did are some of the more radical eco-activists.
Yeah.
And that model, though it's interesting for me, for someone like myself, I respect it. Even though there's damage and there's possible, I guess the Weather Underground did not actually kill anybody because they made a choice not to, and that goes the same with the eco activists. But I think metaphorically, it's a very powerful statement. I just I wouldn't have the courage to do it, and I don't think many people do have the courage to do it. And I'm not even sure I would suggest it. But as a symbol, it resonates. No?
Yeah, I feel much the same way. To me, there's really two ways of looking at it. Was it moral, and was it practical? Was it pragmatic? And morally, I really don't have a huge problem with what they did. the bombings were very minor, and they really made sure everybody was out of the buildings. Nobody was ever hurt, and that was not an accident. And in a certain sense, I see them more like the Boston Tea Party than anything that we consider terrorism today. It was damage against property to make a political statement. And so in that sense, I'm sympathetic. Practically, that's another question. What was it that they were trying to accomplish, and what did they in fact accomplish? And violence is a pretty tricky thing to keep control, to use in a way that you control.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, unfortunately in the society that we live in, it's very easily, you know, that what they were doing and what they were up to and even their place in history can be easily marginalized by the very thing that they were fighting against. Yeah. And also within the left, even Todd Gitlin in your documentary seems still to be, you know, seething,
yeah,
about what the Weather Underground did to the movement that he believed in.
Yeah,
and I think that you still see that fragmentation within, you know, what's left or what is the Democratic Party and what is the left right now, that those same schisms exist now between people who are radical progressives who want to restructure society from the ground up and people who are like trying to play within the margins.
It's true. The left is great at fighting amongst itself, and sometimes I wish that the left was better at just taking the attitude that you do your thing, I'll do mine, and we both generally have the same goal, and it's okay. I don't need to defeat you in order to progress my own agenda.
I don't know if that's possible. I mean, it seems to me that, from my impression, we want to get Mark on the phone here,
sure,
so we'll take a break in a second. That my impression was that the SDS was really trying to restructure the way democracy worked and return it back to what it was supposed to be.
Right.
And what happened was, because of the war, there were factions within the left that believed that something more radical was needed, which sort of threw a wrench into trying to rebuild the system from the ground up.
True, and in that way, the Weather Underground people were some of the most factional and intolerant people there were in 1969. So they were really guilty of that, and most of them feel a lot of regret about that.
Well,
and at that moment, they did not let SDS continue as an above ground organization and go do their underground things, which would have been probably a lot more effective.
Well, look, we'll get Mark Rudd on. I'm very excited to talk to him, and you'll stay on the phone.
Okay, great.
Because you guys know each other. So we'll be back with Sam Green, the filmmaker of the Weather Underground, and Mark Rudd, a member of the Weather Underground, after this.
Now he runs on corn oil. Mark Maron.
Somebody has to. Thanks, folks. This is very exciting. We're on the air right now with Sam Green, who's up in the Bay Area. He's the filmmaker, the Oscar-nominated documentary filmmaker, The Weather Underground. And on the other line, during the 60s, our other guest, Mark Rudd, was the leader of the Columbia University chapter of the Students for a Democratic Society. And he went on to become one of the members of The Weather Underground. Welcome to the show, Mark Rudd.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
It's nice for you to be here, and I'm happy that you're in Albuquerque, my hometown. I love that place. So
I'm happy to be here, too.
Oh, good. So let me just ask you a couple questions. In retrospect, yeah, I mean, you were in the film. You said something very interesting. You talk about how you were not able to mentally assimilate the reality of our country mass murdering millions of Vietnamese people. And you say that you still live with that today, that there's just part of your brain that is unable to comprehend or process that reality. Do you feel that way now with this administration as well?
Absolutely. Of course. Just look at the tens of thousands for murdering in Iraq.
I know. It's just unbelievable. Now, in talking about, Sam and I were talking a bit about some of the methods of the Weather Underground. And in the film, do you still live with some conflict about what you guys did?
Well, I wouldn't exactly call it conflict, because I've actually come down very critically and self-critically about the whole effort, about,
yeah,
the Weather Underground. So I think I'm less conflicted, although in a sense I think regret is always a conflict, yeah.
So now what do you regret?
Well, you know, you mentioned, and I, or maybe Sam mentioned, that it was the height of the war, 1969.
Yeah.
And I happened to have found myself at the national secretary of the largest student radical organization in the country, Students for Democratic Society. We had maybe 100,000 members.
Right.
Maybe 400 chapters, including right here in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I mean, everywhere. SDS was organizing and was active. And at the height of the war, because my comrades and I, my faction, decided that we had the correct way, we made a decision to destroy SDS, just to abandon it, to just scuttle it.
Yeah.
And because it wasn't revolutionary enough.
Wow.
And our definition of revolutionary was guerrilla warfare.
So now, so you're listing that as perhaps a regret that maybe SDS ultimately, as an organization, probably had a longevity to its ideas that you regret seeing dissolve.
Well, that's a question right there as to whether it could have stayed together. Sam talked about an implosion.
Yeah,
we weren't the only ideologues around who thought we had the right way, and there were all kinds of other people claiming to have the correct revolutionary ideas, and we were all contending. But it was that process of, I don't know, maybe you might call it ego, arrogance, that entered into it, that said, well, there is a correct way. But I think in retrospect that what we should have done is just held that organization together and kept organizing in over 400 campuses. It in the year 68 to 69, it doubled in size.
Wow. And also, I think what's interesting about the time that Sam Green was documenting in his film and that you lived through, that the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, the basic discontent and disconnect between the generations of the Eisenhower people and the youth of the day created such a cathartic cultural momentum that it must have been explosive to the point where you couldn't even fathom one of the things I noticed in your movie, Sam, is you really capture that it was just mind-blowing and you couldn't even believe what was going on to be young at that point in time.
Well, that's one of the great things the film accomplishes, is to recapture that moment, especially in archival footage. And a lot of young people can't, they're stunned by that alone, just the archival footage in the movie. But in terms of the excitement of it and the mind-blowing nature of it, I would say that my thinking at the time was a blown mind. You know, we thought that revolution was imminent. Time is right for violent revolution.
But don't you think, Mark, it seems to me that might have been true. It seems to me that, you know, given how the FBI came after you guys, and given that, you know, not many of you did jail time because of their tactics in COINTELPRO, and also the fact that there may have been agent provocateurs in your presence helping you, you know, destroy the SDS, that, you know, there obviously was a threat. There's no reason not to think that revolution wasn't imminent.
No, I disagree with you. I think that there were two groups in the United States that took us seriously. One was ourselves, and the other was the FBI and
right.
the Nixon White House.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that revolution was imminent.
No.
It just means that two marginal groups took ourselves seriously, and so did the stupid FBI.
All right, but okay, so maybe I'm romanticizing a little bit, but before SDS broke apart and before these factions, I mean, you did do some amazing stuff. I mean, I wish I had more time to talk to you about how you broke Tim Leary out of jail and moved him to Algiers. Were you part of that operation?
I was a kind of a behind the scenes kind of secondary part of it. Yeah, I wasn't one of the major people. It wasn't that complicated. He was in a minimum security prison, and he was in very good physical shape, so he went over the wall.
Oh, that was it?
Yeah.
Now, do you have any help? Now, you're working with kids now. I mean, you're a teacher, and are you discouraged? Do you see any hope for any sort of youthful reinvigoration of the peace movement? It seems like Cindy Sheehan has mobilized some people, and there's definitely an elevated awareness of the horrors of war.
it's happening. It's definitely happening. It's not happening in the same way or at the same level, but everywhere I go, I'm talking to young people. I was just at a tiny little college in Fort Worth, Texas, and a couple hundred people came out to talk about the war and what can be done about it.
Hey, Sam, are you working on another film?
I am working on another film.
What do you got going?
It's a documentary about hope and utopia.
Great. So this is all coming together. Now, how do we get that? When does that happen?
I don't work very fast, so that may be a couple of years.
I was hoping. Do you have any answer in terms of when we get the actual utopia or hope period, you know, in real life?
Well, that maybe a year or two after the movie comes out.
Now, Mark Rudd, you seem very well adjusted, and you seem like a very decent fella, considering everything you've gone through, and I appreciate that. And in the film, it seems like a lot of you guys are pretty well adjusted and thoughtful. Are you in contact? Are there Weather Underground reunions? Do you chat?
Well, I am in contact with most people on and off. Some of them are my best friends. Some of them are not. But we're all kind of like a brothers and sisters who maybe had disagreements, you know. But you know, one thing about the Weather Underground that's kind of interesting is we're all good middle-class kids, middle-class white kids.
Yeah.
And we were all kind of well-meaning. There wasn't a huge kind of a psychotic or criminal element among us. And in fact, if one of the things I've learned from Sam is to respect the fact that we went over to the edge, which was bombing and killing, using bombs to attack people. We went to that edge and pulled back. So
yeah,
we weren't totally psychotic.
Right, but and you definitely had the moral dialogue, and you definitely, there was a lot of debate, and I thought that, you know, some of the end of the SDS and the beginning of the Weather Underground, it seemed like there was a lot of active politicking in going on in general in terms of within the organization. We got to go, fellas. Sam Green, thanks for joining us. Mark Rudd, really appreciate it. Say hi to Albuquerque for me.
Okay,
thank you.
Can I say one thing?
What?
When your country is killing millions of people, it's kind of hard to know what to do about it.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mark Rudd. I appreciate it. Sam Green, we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
You bet, man. Wow. That was kind of exciting. We'll be back. Stay with us.
Now his balance is outstanding. Mark Maron.
Man, thanks, Jim. That interview with Sam Green and Mark Rudd just blew me away. You know, Mark Rudd lives in Albuquerque.
Been there
for 30 years.
Yeah.
Knew some friends of mine. My old.
So you want to get violent.
My old mentor, Gus Blaisdell. Yeah. No, I thought what he was saying was interesting about ego and what we were talking about before. Because I believe that a lot of people who claim to be activists or claim to be progressive politically or the loudest mouthed of them, many of them are just, you know, angry people or seeking attention. I find that most people that really facilitate change are people who work quietly and chip away at the system and try to not necessarily even undermine it, but move it from the inside, but that care about people, that aren't grandstanders.
You're telling me I learned that big mistake in the SLA.
Yeah, when back in the day? Was this after you were involved
mistake.
A little bit with the Manson and you were, you know, disillusioned?
Well, you know, when you go from Manson, you got to move up. You got to go up to the higher levels.
But the other issue is just on a philosophical level, or even on a psychological level, one of the liabilities of being, you know, megalomaniacal or egocentric is that you'll be accused of that. So despite the fact that that may be the reason you're doing something, doesn't take anything away from what you're doing. Yeah, that's one of the ways that people character assassinate people that make, you know, political progress in a direction they may not want it in. Like the right can always say, like, you know, Martin Luther King was a womanizer. Bill Clinton, you know, got BJs in the Oval Office. The liability of being a big character, a big ego, somebody who needs that type of attention, is what it is. It doesn't disregard what you achieve.
It's like show business. Anybody who wants that much attention has got to be insane to begin with.
Well, yeah, but necessary is what I'm saying. And thank God we have our guy on the beat We've got Jeff DiCarlo. Of course, you know him. Jeff DiCarlo is a tax activist. He is a biowave analyst. He is a camp counselor. Occasionally, he is he's helped you and I work some stuff out.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay. He was a homebound immigration protester, as you recall. He did that protest from his bed.
Yeah.
And he's with us now. I think it's fitting, you know, after talking to Mark Rudd and Sam Green about what activism used to be like, to talk to a guy who's on it now. Do you know what I'm saying? Jeff DiCarlo, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Go ahead, sorry.
Oh, I was just saying it's very inspiring to hear you talking about people making change from within and starting on a smaller level, but towards a greater impact. Because I feel that that's what I'm doing.
That's great. So we just talked to a member of the Weather Underground. I mean, these guys blew things up, whatever you may say about them, they were part of the real deal. What do you got going? I know you were, the last time we talked to you, you were in bed, and I think you made a big difference during the immigration protest. What do you got going now?
Well, you know, it's funny that you mentioned the Weather Underground, because while I was doing my bed protest, I was able to Netflix the documentary about the Weather Underground, and I found it hugely influential, and I've decided to be inspired by them and to take it into the new millennium, to take their work and sort of inspired a more quiet rage in me.
Like, what are you talking about?
Well,
right,
I've started a new radical group called the Internal Liberation Front, and what we're doing is it's inspired by the Weather Underground.
Right, sure.
For instance, instead of the days of rage, we're having the days of laze, where we are encouraging people to just relax, to just take it easy in a very aggressive way.
So, hold on, Seth. So, aggressively take it easy. Now, how exactly does this facilitate change in any way? How is this a protest?
Well, listen, can you imagine what we would do to the capitalist system if we all just took it down a notch? If at work we didn't give 110%, we gave maybe 40%. What I'm encouraging people to do is to rise up, not too early or too fast, but to rise up and to show that we are not just pawns in this capitalist game. We're not just cogs in this machine. And to prove that, we are going to aggressively relax.
Okay.
I'm staging nap-ins in different cities.
What's a nap-in? What is a
nap-in? A nap-in is where we go and we take naps in the middle of the day. I'm trying to.
Is this an outdoor thing?
Pardon me?
Outdoors or?
Outdoors, indoors. We want to do it on. We want to have a million man nap on the Capitol steps where we just relax. And, you know, as a biowave analyst, I have scientifically proven with devices that I've made myself that relaxation is contagious. And if we make Congress sleepy, right? If we make the powers that be a little hazy, a little yawny, then we can allow them to listen to us, to our concerns.
But you're going to be sleeping.
Well, that's just one phase. That's just one phase.
That's phase one.
Rome wasn't built in a day, and the revolution isn't going to start with just one thing.
So,
this is.
So you're saying that
huge.
Ultimately, like I'm going to be at the million man nap. I wouldn't miss that. And so you're basically saying that it's sort of like when you yawn in front of someone else, they yawn too. So you guys are all, there's a million man nap going on the Great Lawn in front of the White House, in front of the Capitol, or around the corner from the White House anyways, and you're saying that legislators will look out the window and maybe, oh, I'm a little tired too, and everybody will nap, and then you all sort of wake up with that kind of like open mind, early morning kind of feeling, and you just kind of facilitate a dialogue a little bit. Like, hey, so what?
Absolutely, or conversely, you know how sometimes after a nap you wake up a little cranky and you kind of feel like you're about to cry for no reason?
Yeah.
We feel that if we can put Congress in that state, they might listen to us, right? So what we want to do is yawn collectively. We want to have one giant mouth yawning all at the same time.
All right, well, that sounds...
The subheading of our movement is the paradigm shift hits the fan, and that is really what we're going to make happen.
By taking it
out of the streets and into the home first.
Yeah.
I'm encouraging people to rest. I'm living by example, and if people want to support me, they can bring me some pale ales and some American spirits, because I'm going to hole up in my house. I'm getting ready right now. I'm in training for the million man nap.
Yeah.
I'm trying to sleep at least 14 hours a day.
Right.
And I'm just, you know, I'm learning to, I went online, I learned how to give myself a sponge bath because I am not leaving this bed until I get enough people involved. And then I can start to make my way slowly and very calmly out into the world.
Okay, so that's great, Jeff DiCarlo. Yeah, it's always encouraging and inspirational to talk to you about what you're doing and the movement. Any other plans for the movement? You got any other on the list of things that have to be done, radical things?
Well, absolutely. Well, you know, as the Weather Underground broke Timothy Leary out of jail, and we want to, just symbolically, we're going to break Timothy Leary's cryogenically frozen head out of the ICE jail that it's kept in now.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We want to access that wonderful mind.
Yeah,
and I know
sure.
he turned them in and ratted them out, but that's not the part that we're going to access.
Right,
we're
right.
Gonna access the, fun,
you're gonna,
the
good part, yeah.
Yeah, the really trippy part. And some of the other things that we're going to do, I mean, this is a, you know, because the political is personal and the personal is political.
Yeah.
I'm going to be breaking my dog, Tosh, out of dog jail. He was impounded because he bit a mailman and he's not registered and all these other things that
all right.
Society would have you do.
Well, it sounds like you got a plan. And look, I'm going to have someone bring the American Spirits and the Pale Ale over. You do your laundry, get those sheets clean, and get ready to train. And as soon as this Million Man Nap thing, we're on the precipice of it, we'll have you back on, and we'll get people to meet you in Washington.
Okay. I'm also trying to start a movement where we can use ramen as currency, because I have just a whole kitchen full of ramen that I think I should be able to use to buy other things.
Maybe that's why you weep after you wake up from a nap.
You know what? Weeping is some of the little exercise that I get, and I don't think it should be criticized.
I think this whole thing is pathetic, Mark. I just, I don't know why you pay so much lip service. This guy is just laying around his apartment asking for free handouts.
He's living.
He's not doing a damn thing.
He is living.
It's an embarrassment.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That is really
interesting. I'm sorry, Jeff.
Really, I thought we were on the same side.
You need
to hang up your hang-ups. You know that?
Yeah, hear that, Jim? He's just jealous of you, Jeff. He's just jealous.
Yeah, I'd like some free beer sent over to my place.
See? I'll take care of that. All right, can we
I'd like to take naps indiscriminately.
I'd appreciate it if you would quit s***ing all over me.
Should
Shooting. I really would. I really would.
Take care, Jeff. You keep in touch.
I know it doesn't feel good to feel what you're feeling, and I feel sorry for you.
That's a lot of negativity.
Jeff, thank you so much.
I got to go play with my cats. I just got a new laser pointer.
Okay. Take care. Jeff DiCarlo. Look, folks. Okay, you know, Jim,
we get
a guy that believes in something, you got to do that. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that listeners know what's going on in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So here now is our very own Planet Bush Bureau Chief, Lawton Smalls. Hello, Lawton.
Hello, Mark. You know, every time it rains pennies from heaven. Or if you're in a red state, quarters.
Okay, buddy.
More profitable.
Yeah, all right, buddy. Listen, let me run this by you. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has predicted this year's hurricane season will be above normal and very active. What do you think of that, man?
Oh, I know all about that, Mark. You know, I keep up with these things. It's very important to stay current.
Really?
So, important, yeah.
So you've been keeping up with the latest scientific announcements, what?
Science? Oh, Lord, no. Spread that fertilizer somewhere else, Copernicus. Secular humanism. Chaos theory. Darwin. Those are Jesus killers right there. Evil equals MC squared.
Okay.
Period.
So, all right, fine. So where'd you hear about the hurricanes then?
From the Reverend Pat Robertson. Yeah. 2 weeks ago, the Lord spake unto him directly in an impressive, well-modulated voice and said, Pat, my servant, there will be tempests in the land of the wicked between June and, you know, late October, November, more or less.
Yeah.
You know, Reverend Pat goes right to the source. That man is my Weather Channel.
Really? That guy's my Comedy Central, Lawton.
Oh.
But anyway, look, we agree it's going to be a bad year for storms.
Well, not for the righteous, not for the God-fearing.
Mm.
We're going to be just fine. Reverend Pat said the coasts are going to be lashed. You got that?
Uh-huh.
And there's going to be a tsunami in the Northwest.
Mm.
And California, where you're at, y'all should think about getting some hip waders, son.
Uh-huh.
Your house is about to become a bass boat.
Now why let me ask you something, Lawton. Why would we get harder than, say, the Gulf Coast, huh?
Gay agenda. Well-known fact that coastal gays are killing the environment.
Oh.
Well, now it's payback time. You messed with the moral climate, mister. Now God's going to mess with your Climate. That's what's happening.
All right, Watson. So you're telling me gays are killing the environment? Did God tell Pat Robertson that, too?
Yeah, all right. Come on. Let me tell you something else.
Yeah.
The lower the approval numbers get for President George W. two-terms mandate Bush, the worse the storms are going to be.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. Cause and effect. You better get with the Bush agenda, mister, or get ready for a whole lot of mildew in your house, baby killer.
Hey, now just stop that, Lawton. Just stop it. Speaking of Bush, is he going to do anything to prepare for this season? Because he totally failed last year. It was obscene. Shameful, Lawton.
Yeah, the only thing he failed to do was interfere with the Lord's justice.
Whoa.
The president is a very powerful masculine leader, as we all know, but when the Lord wants to rain down his judgment on the wicked, the Christian thing to do is to just step aside and let that happen, you know.
Mm.
Spare the rod and spoil the child, Mark.
Well, let me tell you something, Lawton. That is some God you've got there, buddy. Wiping out thousands of poor, defenseless people. When you talk to him, you tell him I think he's a creep, buddy. All right? Oh, yeah. Okay. What?
Mark?
What?
God does talk to me.
Uh-huh.
He does. Just like Pat Robertson.
Right.
Last year during the hurricanes, I heard a voice.
Mm.
Lawton, yes, Lord? Why art thou punishing thy children with tempests? I asked. He said, I'm not punishing anyone, you idiot. Hurricanes are caused by global warming.
Mm.
If you paid more attention to science, you'd know that. Goodbye, Lawton Smalls. I said, wait, Lord.
Yeah.
Thou wanted to say something unto me.
Yeah.
And God said, yeah, well, I changed my mind. Later, dumbass.
All right. Okay. Lawton, just pull it together. God was having a bad day, I guess. Can you just pull it together?
Mark.
What?
Does God still love me? Deal with it.
Look, I'm sure he does, Lawton, okay? He's just very busy keeping gay people from getting married, okay? Does that make you feel better? What?
Well, yeah, that would take up a lot of time.
All right. Wow.
The coast, Mark.
Yeah.
The coastline. Look at a map, okay? Now look at where you are. Coastlines. Get out your rubbers and watch the sky.
All right.
Here it comes.
Goodbye, Lawton.
Here it comes. God loves you. Deal with it. Put on them rubbers.
All right, I will. All right, well, that's good. Okay, there's Lawton. We got the short order news coming up here in just a few minutes. Right, Jim? You are jealous.
Put those rubbers on.
You're jealous of Jeff DiCarlo.
Hey, man.
You don't know people like that? What the hell did you do all day?
Hey, you know, I'm napping right now. Okay. I'll tell you that.
All right, we'll be back with the short order news.
And now, what the hell is wrong with you, Mark Maron?
Exactly. What is wrong with me? I feel better. I've been taking some action.
Action?
Yes. I'm taking some action to deal with my issues. That's what you got to do. Once you recognize them, you can't just say, hey, there they are. Live with it. If you want to have friends, you want to have lovers, you want to have a wife or a significant other.
Would you rather have a friend or friends or a lover?
I don't even know how I managed the life I used to live, Jim. I have no idea when I was first married, when I was drinking and drugging and everything else and messing around. I have no idea how I managed that life. And now, when I think about it, I'm exhausted. The juggling, the lying, and everything else, that's not happening. Now I'm just dealing with the sort of simmering resentment and strange need for my mommy. Hey, listen to this. A series of filmmakers say internet porn shapes many young people's perception of sex. This is an interesting thing here. This happened in Cannes, out at Cannes, and they had a discussion about it. And I think it's true and it's disturbing just how much porn there is out here, how accessible it is to everybody, and how much, you know, when you see porn, I know it changed my perception of sex. When was the first time you saw porn?
When I was like 7.
Real? Yeah. Wow. That's really?
My friend had a brother, big brother, was a Vietnam vet. They live across the street.
Mm.
And he brought over, you know, one of his brother's Playboys, I think. I don't even think it was a Playboy. It was pretty explicit. It was pretty, you know.
Yeah, okay.
Like in 1968 or 7, you know.
Wow, okay. So you were pretty young. But you didn't actually see, hey, what's that doing? You didn't see, like,
I had no idea what it meant. But
that looks messy.
I knew it was important. Because I hid it under my bed.
Maybe this is a longer discussion than we have right now. Look, we're going to have this. I'm making note of that. Vietnam vet, Jim 7, Playboy for tomorrow or the next day.
Not even. I think it was something like Penthouse or something. Grade B porn, big magazine.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, here's. We don't need to be caught off guard or uninformed. Here's the second edition of the Mark Maron Show Short Order News. President Bush said Tuesday that if Israel were attacked by Iran, the United States would come to its aid. As a token of appreciation, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert gave President a T-shirt with an Israeli flag on it that read, "Just white and blue. These colors don't run." Just white and blue. After hearing the President's statement, New Orleans residents are now asking Iran to attack them for the aid. According to a new study at the University of California, Los Angeles Marijuana... University of California, Los Angeles, marijuana smoking does not increase a person's risk of developing lung cancer. The study compared lifestyles of 1,200 cancer patients with 1,040 people without cancer and found that even people without cancer believe that bad things only happen to them. An exotic chicken that was saved from drowning by mouth-to-beak resuscitation more than 3 months ago has died, her owner said Tuesday. The chicken will be buried in the Arlington Poultry Cemetery next to Colonel Sanders and General Sow. Let's see.
Colonel Sanders.
Short order news for tonight. Tomorrow, the righteous Latino metal band El Nino will be here, at least a couple of them. Dean Baker, the author of The Conservative Nanny State, will be here. Hal Buell, this guy's a famous guy. He used to be the AP photo editor-in-chief, is going to be on to talk about his book about Iwo Jima, that famous photograph, that inspirational photograph, and other things. Have a good night, sheeple.